You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome in hour two of the Mike Allen Show here on this Monday, October 3rd. Let's get our week started off right. Stick with me for the next hour. I have a conversation in the next segment with my friend Rick Becker. Rick, who is a nursing professor, Catholic convert, and an excellent writer. He writes for the National Catholic Register and other publications and has his own blog, God Haunted Lunatic. We'll actually be talking about an article he wrote, I believe it was in Catholic Exchange, in which he talks about praying the rosary and even when it gets interrupted, and the work sometimes of guardian angels in helping finish those rosaries. So we'll have a good conversation with Rick Becker about this, hopefully in the next segment. Again, my question of the day, if you're making a pot of chili, what do you want in it besides a spoon? 573-4-BREAD-4, 573-4-BREAD-4. As I said last hour, the temperature does not have to drop too much, maybe just get below 80. And for my wife, that's chili season. And so she starts brewing up a big pot, and we worked on it the whole weekend long. And unfortunately, it's almost out now. But maybe it's time for another pot. That's why I'm asking for advice. 573-4-BREAD-4 if you want to chime in, or you can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. It all kind of goes together. Some responses we've gotten, by the way, on Facebook on this is, Sarah says, always add some spiced up tomato paste. Steve says, beef that's been grilled over charcoal, that wonderful smoky flavor permeates the whole batch. I like that idea. Abigail says beans plus sour cream on top. So what say you? Love to hear from you on that if you want to chime in. Over the weekend, had the feast day of St. Therese of Lisieux this past Saturday. Saint Doctor of the Church, one of the first Catholic saints that I was not aware of that I came to know on my journey into the church, read her spiritual autobiography, Story of a Soul, which is an amazing, amazing work, because you see in her deep love for Christ, her very simple love and yet profound at the same time, and her little way. She, of course, became one of the very popular saints of the early 20th century, one of those who was not named a saint or a doctor of the church because necessarily of her voluminous theological works, but because she got to the heart of what it is to be a disciple of Christ, and that's to love Jesus with her whole heart. There was a great piece in the Catholic Education Resource Center, though, about St. Therese of Lisieux, the last 18 months of her life, sometimes known as the Passion of St. Therese of Lisieux. And I'm going to post a link to this on the show's Facebook page. And I'm hoping to get Mr. Sparrow on the program. He lives in New Zealand, which makes things a little bit trickier, but not impossible in this shrinking world we live in. He writes, Therese Martin certainly deserved canonization, but it's helpful to unwrap the legend a little so that we can gain an insight into the authentic Therese. In pious treatises on St. Therese of Lisieux, he says, and there are literally thousands of them, the saint has been taken over by a legend that invariably portrays her as one of those classic, sweet-looking holy card types. He says, there's no doubt many people bolster their faith with this sort of image, but there's probably an equal number who find such pious post-mortem accretions very off-putting. It's probably the kind of thing that Dorothy Day talked about when the question was raised about her canonization. She said, please don't make me a saint. I don't want to be dismissed that easily. As Sparrow writes here, Therese Martin certainly deserved canonization, but it's helpful at times to unwrap the legend so we can gain insight into the authentic Therese, and in the process discovered that in the last 18 months of her life, not only did she suffer the real agony of the tuberculosis that ultimately killed her at age 24, but that she also suffered the agony of abandonment by God. A trial of faith that at times shrouded her soul in the utmost turmoil, and it was only her passionate love of God that helped her conquer this turmoil, and in doing so, establish her sanctity beyond all doubt. It's one of the things I mentioned Saturday night. I was at an event that we have every year in the diocese. The bishop celebrates Mass, a Mass for couples married a jubilee number of years, which the way we define it is 10 years, 25 years, 40 years, 50 years, and 50 plus. We had couples married 70 years there this year. Talked about how not only do you have St. Therese, but her parents, Louis and Zélie Martin, who were beatified, because typically saints are born out of a certain soil, and the soil of Louis and Zélie, particularly fertile in terms of their parenthood and own witness to the faith. So Sparrow goes on to talk about the facts of Therese's life. Born in 1873 in the Normandy town of Alencon, the youngest of five daughters. She was only four when her mother died of cancer. Her day-to-day upbringing was in the hands of her two oldest sisters, Marie and Pauline. She would become, of course, I think, Therese, the third daughter to enter into the cloistered convent. Of course, you know the story about how they weren't going to let her in until she got to be a certain age, and she actually went as part of an audience with the Pope and begged him to grant her permission to enter the convent at her 15th birthday. She did receive special permission because of her persistence in faith, took the name Sister Therese of the Infant Jesus of the Holy Face. We may pick this up a little bit later in the week. We don't have to rush through it. This great story, I'm going to post the link on the show's Facebook page so you can check it out. But I know that Cardinal Ratzinger at the time, now Pope Benedict, of course, actually this was, I think he was just Father Ratzinger, wrote a book called Introduction to Christianity, and he talks about Therese's struggle late in her life in the midst of her suffering, temptations to atheism, even, which to my mind does not in any way erode the image of her sanctity, but actually deepens it and strengthens it, much like the revelations that St. Teresa of Calcutta went through her own dark night of the soul, and yet continued in fidelity, magnifies her virtue, rather than in any way degrades it. So I'll put a link to that on the show's Facebook page. It's a really, really good article from Stephen Sparrow. I think the more we can understand, get past sometimes the, as he calls it, the sort of accretions to see the real person. Because these are the type of people, you know, sometimes people, I'm not that kind of person. I'm not the kind of person that could be a saint. Well, you really have no other option if you want to be in heaven, for one thing. Not that you have to be canonized, but we do have to be made perfect in love to enter the joy of heaven. And you know what? God makes saints from sinners because he really doesn't have any other material to work with. So that's good news for you and me. Anyway, back to this book I was telling you about in the last hour, Jesus Shock by Peter Kraft, teaches at Boston College, where he was talking about real presence and what that means. You know, that Jesus, it was his presence in the incarnation. We talked about this last week with Sobar Amari, the Wall Street Journal editorial writer who has gone from being an atheist, someone who was born and raised nominally Muslim, became an atheist, and now drawn to the Catholic faith. It was the incarnation for him, that God would enter in the person of Jesus this fallen world to redeem it. And this is what Kraft is talking about with real presence. Jesus didn't just come as an idea or pointing to a way or telling us about ethereal truths. He came in his very person, his presence. And he goes on to talk about what real presence is. He said it's not simply bodily presence, because you could bump into somebody you don't know and not recognize their presence. It's also not just mental presence, as though if someone were thousands of miles away, they were present in your thoughts, but they're not really present. He said real presence involves both physical and mental presence, but it's also something more. He said, remember Job's three friends? And we were just talking about Job last week. They all came to talk about God with theological correctness, as if he were absent, while Job talked to him as present, though his ideas about him were confused and mistaken. Job was rewarded. God appeared to Job, but not to the three friends, even though the three friends had spoken of God. Why? Because Job had practiced God's presence. He prayed. He alone talked to God as present, even though he did not feel that presence. The three friends were basically deists. Deists who believe God created the world and then left it to its own devices. He said most theists are deists most of the time. In practice, if not in theory, they practice the absence of God instead of the presence of God. Now, we'll be unpacking this over the course of the week, because this chapter, particularly its implications for the Catholic belief in the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist, is so foundational and fundamental to our understanding and the economy of salvation. And it's really an obstacle of sorts, a division point between Catholics and Protestants, that the longer I'm Catholic, the less I understand. Why would Christ not make himself really present to us, body, blood, soul, and divinity, as he does in the Blessed Sacrament? And it really is one of the great mysteries and really animating truths that should bring comfort and strength for the believer seeking to live in the world. So we'll unpack this a little bit more as we go. This is from Peter Kraeft's book, Jesus Shock. Really, really good stuff. We'll be back in a minute with my friend Rick Becker. This is the Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Past the hour. You're back on the Mike Allen Show. We're blessed to have, via phone, Rick Becker with us. Rick, who is a husband, father of seven, nursing instructor, and religious educator, lives with his family in South Bend, Indiana. He and his wife, Nancy, serve as co-directors of religious education at St. Matthew Cathedral there. He's also in the nursing faculty at Bethel College in Mishawaka, Indiana. You can find more of his writing on his blog, God Haunted Lunatic. He also writes for the National Catholic Register, and he's currently tucked away in a closet somewhere trying to find a quiet place in his busy house. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning, Mike.
Yeah, the getting ready for school routine, pretty crazy. So we'll be glad to have you here as long as we can have you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Let's talk about this article on Catholic Exchange. I don't know if you've written for Catholic Exchange a good bit, but came across this on interrupted rosaries and guardian angels. Of course, this, I believe it's this Friday, will be the Our Lady of Victory or Our Lady of the Rosary. My parish is Mary Queen of the Holy Rosary, so it's a great month.
Well, big feast for you guys.
Exactly, and we actually celebrated it this past weekend. It's a little bit movable for a parish dedicated to the rosary. So, and you know, we Catholics can't go to church some other time than Sunday. So that's what we do. But I digress. Anyway, let's talk about the rosary, because it's a great month to talk about it. And what inspired you to write this article?
Well, I, as you know from the article, I what prompted it was my praying the rosary in the car, which I'm not sure how many of your listeners do that, but that's sometimes, particularly when I've got a very busy schedule, clinical schedule, that seems to be the only time I have a chunk of time to devote to praying the rosary. And especially early in the morning, it can be a very meditative time as long as I'm paying attention to the road, but that my drive to work doesn't take a whole rosary, so I'm left with that last decade. And I was thinking about how, what does that mean? What does it mean to interrupt a rosary? Can you pray it in pieces? And of course you can. The guardian angel connection was in a sense asking my guardian angel to remind me to do that last decade some other point in the day. But there was I reflected on a number of things in that article. The idea of the interrupted rosary, I think, brings up the point that the rosary isn't for Mary. So it's not like Mary is disappointed if we don't complete a full rosary, even a single decade, even a single Hail Mary prayed with devotion is certainly going to be pleasing to her. And what's more, even more important, is going to be beneficial to me. Our prayers are not, God doesn't need our prayers. Mary doesn't need our prayers. We're the ones that need the prayer. Mm. We're the ones that are formed by our prayers. Even intercessory prayer, even when we're asking God for things, the way we ask, the way we're formed, the way that we're we enter into that intercessory role is forming who we become. So there's a lot of things in there. I have to say, I'm glad you brought up about Our Lady of Victory, because another thing that the Guardian Angel Feast, of course, would have been yesterday if it hadn't been Sunday. October 2nd, and this whole week, this is a little bit of a digression, but this whole week is one of my favorite weeks of the year of in the sacral cycle. I just love this time from the Archangels to Our Lady of Victory. There's the only week I like better is the week after Christmas and all the feasts that follow Christmas.
We had St. Therese of Lisieux on Saturday as well.
That's right. We had St. Therese. We have St. Francis tomorrow. We have St. Bruno on the 6th. This is the saints and all the history and the images and the inspiration that we get from the calendar of saints this week is one of my favorites. Mm. But particularly with the guardian angels, when you have children and you teach them their guardian angel prayer, I still pray my guardian angel prayer with
Absolutely.
Them, of course. But I think that idea of the angels praying with us as well as praying for us, and particularly that tradition, it's certainly not church teaching, but that tradition of guardian angels finishing our rosaries when we fall asleep. If we say a rosary as we're falling asleep, there's a long-standing tradition that our guardian angels finish them for us. But I just like that image of guardian angels praying with us and being at our side as we're involved in the spiritual warfare.
Don't you think it's easy, Rick? The rosary, of course, such a great pride of place in Catholic devotional history. Of course, the Church in her wisdom doesn't require any particular method of spiritual devotion. You could be a good Catholic your whole life and never pray the rosary, and some people have a difficult time with it, but there's such a richness there. And I think part of it is, though, is our attitude toward it. If we see the rosary as simply something we're doing to earn points or just to check off that we did it, as opposed to understanding the rosary not as something God needs, not as something we need to earn God's favor, but as an opportunity to enter into these mysteries and to be accompanied by Mary, who can help us pray even more effectively.
That's right. And people, especially Protestants, my students, as you know, Mike, I teach at an evangelical college, so the vast majority of my students are Protestants, and eventually they get around to asking me, they're curious about my Catholicism, and one of the questions is the rosary. They ask, how can you benefit from just repeating these same prayers, even though they're biblical? I mean, I get them to understand that, by and large, the rosary is a thoroughly biblical prayer. All those prayers are very much rooted in Scripture, taken directly from Scripture. But then what's the benefit of praying them over and over again? And I try to help them understand it is the rosary is a meditative prayer. It enters it. It allows you that rote, and rote isn't a bad word. By praying those prayers over and over, it allows you to enter into a state in which you can be meditating on, contemplating those different mysteries and being in the presence. They allow you to enter into God's presence, and so that you're not, in a sense, the repetition allows you to have the freedom to focus on something other than trying to come up with something else to say. It's like the scripture, the words of scripture in those prayers repeated give you a put you in the presence of God. And so I do love the rosary, and I try to help my students to see that, for instance, like even in the article I use the image of driving in the car and having a conversation with your friend. Your being in the car together, in a sense, gives you that space to carry on the conversation, and in a sense, the repetition of the different prayers of the rosary are a vehicle in which we can carry on a different conversation, a different level with the Lord and with the Blessed Mother.
Our pastor yesterday, Father Dan, you know, again, our parish is Mary Queen of the Holy Rosary. He said when he first, 6 years ago, found out he was appointed to the parish, that he was just very honest. He said, you know, my rosary praying was pretty intermittent. He said, I realized I was going to have to commit, if I'm pastor of Mary Queen of the Holy Rosary, I'm going to have to pray a rosary every day. It's just, you know, I can't be the pastor of a church named for the rosary and not do that. And he said what he's discovered over the years, he said, is, you know, it's kind of like when you go to the doctor and the doctor is asking you to make a change in diet or to exercise more faithfully. He said, you know, you may do that for a few days and be like, oh, I don't feel any different. Nothing's changed. He said, but it's in that ongoing pattern. That's really where the effect of the rosary comes in. It's not in a one-time. You really have to have that endurance with it, he said, and then you begin to see how it's shaping you.
Exactly, yeah. I do think the word shaping is important. Certainly we do have St. Paul moments of thunder and lightning, and, you know, like it's like confession, too. Particularly for adult converts, your first confession, nothing will ever... nothing will ever surpass that in terms of its monumental impact on your life. But overall, over a lifetime of confessions, you can't point to any. Usually, it's not any particular confession that marked a dramatic change in direction in your life. But it's a ongoing shaping of the soul with confession after confession, rosary after rosary, mass after mass, communion after communion. It's that drip. It's that drip, drip, drip into our souls that the economy of grace, the sacramental economy. That's what it's designed to do. Baptism, of course, is singular, but everything else is a shaping, something that's driven by time. And we're grateful. That's one thing that we can be grateful for, that God gives us that time. He gives us time to be shaped. And we're grateful for the sacraments that are the primary instrument of his shaping.
Well, Rick, we're about out of time. I appreciate you giving us the time today. Thank your wife especially, because I know she's she's helping to get the kids ready too. So
you're welcome, Mike. I'll tell her that, and I'll get back out there into the fray.
And as you said, great idea. Let's ask our guardian angel to remind us to pray. That's a great way that they can serve us as well.
That's true.
All right.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Take care.
All right, you too.
We'll be back with more in just a minute. This is the Mike Allen Show. If you want to be a part, 573-4-BREAD-4. We'll be right back.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
We're right at the bottom of the hour back on the Mike Allen Show. Again, my question of the day, if you're making a pot of chili, what do you like in it? 573-4-BREAD-4, 573-4-BREAD-4. You can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. I don't typically, even though I'm just 75 miles south of Cincinnati, where they're famous for putting cinnamon in their chili. And I love the chili from up there. And there's a place called Skyline Chili. If I'm ever in the Cincinnati area and I get an opportunity, I get some Skyline Chili or some La Rosa's Pizza. But so I'm not, my mom puts cinnamon in her chili. I don't have a problem with it. I'm not a chili snob. But typically, we don't put cinnamon in our chili. And usually a couple of cans of beer and a big pot of chili. Mmm, it's good stuff. And oyster crackers. I'm into oyster crackers these days. Just a ton of oyster crackers in my chili. So you may disagree. And I go back and forth with the noodles thing, too. So love to hear from you. 573-4-BREAD-4. Very, very important, deep, intellectual topic. Chili making. 573-4-BREAD-4. Email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Always enjoy talking to Rick Becker. The guy's just a phenomenal witness for the faith and a deep thinker. Came across an article yesterday, actually, in our local paper here in Lexington, Kentucky, where we broadcast from. There's a the Commonwealth attorney for the county. He's the chief prosecutor for the county, Ray Larson. He is retiring, I guess, after many years on the job. He's just the prototypical tough guy prosecutor. I hear him on the local radio sometimes. And, you know, I've always had a great deal of respect, I think, for Ray Larson, because I think he's somebody whose intentions are good anyway. But he often talks about, in his remarks, his frustration sometimes at the lack of consideration for victims in the legal system in our country. And there was an interview with him, with a retiring Commonwealth attorney, Ray Larson, in our local paper. He said in his years of prosecuting criminals, he's learned not to dwell on the past. 73 years old, he's been the Lexington, Fayette County's top prosecutor since 1985. One of the things they asked him was, what drives you in this office? He said, I felt that if someone breaks the law, they should suffer consequences. And right now. And that just is reinforced over and over again after you see people do unbelievable things to victims who were not volunteers for the criminal justice system. The criminals picked them. The unfortunate thing is that the victims frequently have to live with the results all their life, even if the bad guy gets a 10-year prison sentence and gets out and moves on. The victim is stuck with what's happened to them, particularly survivors of homicide victims. So it's so easy to caricature a prosecutor as some sort of Javert, you know, from Les Mis, that there's somebody who simply is driven to punish people. But it's very obvious from Larson, who I've heard over the years, and it'd be very easy to have that caricature of him until you read this interview and realize that for him, it's about the victims. One of the questions he was asked in this interview, one of your foci, I guess. One of your focuses has been the care of victims and the families of victims. Could you talk about why? He said, Larson says, I get mad as hell when I meet the families of victims whose sons were completely innocent and they're dead because of some jerk. Those people didn't ask for this. But if you'd ever meet them, the hurt that is still in their eyes at the loss of a child just breaks your heart. The criminal justice system, in my opinion, he says, treats victims like dog manure. The criminals have all of the rights. Victims have no rights. He goes on to talk about trials. He says trials are awful. Victims think they'll go to trial and things are going to be better. They never are. It's worse. Think about it. They have to sit and listen to bad things about their loved ones at trial. They think all this pain is going to go away, and it never does. It never does. I think about this. What struck me when I read this interview, and I'll post a full link to it on the show's Facebook page, this article about Ray Larson, who's stepping down, is that I think sometimes, you know, we're in the church, we're in the year of mercy. that we so often identify mercy exclusively with the guilty offender. I think about this, for example, in the whole debates about divorce and remarriage and so forth, and the church's unchanging teaching for 2,000 years, rooted in the very words of Christ himself, that a valid marriage is indissoluble except by death. It was something that first got the attention of Jesus' critics. They approached him with a question about marriage and divorce because Moses allowed divorce. Now, it was typically one way the man could divorce his wife for virtually any reason, not the other way around. And here Jesus seemed to talk about marriage as if it was indissoluble. And they confronted him. Are you going to contradict Moses? Which would be like a political candidate in our day and age saying, you know, I'm not a big fan of the thought of Thomas Jefferson and George Washington. I mean, it's just you don't do it. So to go against Moses, so to speak, but Jesus essentially said, look, Moses, he gave you divorce because of the hardness of your hearts. It was not what was intended in the beginning. Jesus, who had the unique authority to, of course, override Moses, to point back to the Father's original plan that he had come, of course, to restore. But here's the thing that gets me so many times on this whole issue of persons enter into a second marriage after they're divorced and their original spouse is still alive, and the church beginning with the presumption that original marriage is valid unless proven otherwise. Therefore, a person may not. It's not that they're not allowed to. It's just that they cannot be validly married again in the church while their original spouse is still alive unless it's proven through a declaration of nullity there was something lacking. And people usually, when they think about mercy in those situations, 99% of the time, they think about the one who's seeking the remarriage. And they talk about things like, well, shouldn't we allow that? Or, you know, out of mercy for the person, you know, they got divorced and we're all imperfect and so forth. And yes, yeah, absolutely, we're all broken. And Jesus himself engaged with a divorced woman at the well at Samaria. And yes, but here's what we often forget. What about the spouse who didn't want the divorce? Not all divorces, in fact, maybe the majority of them, have one person who pursues it and one person who wants to reconcile. How often do we think about mercy for the one who was abandoned, for the one who was put aside, and how unmerciful it is for those representing the church to simply nod and wink at the person who abandoned their spouse and now it is seeking to enter into another union, maybe even with the person they left their original spouse for. It's because we tend to orient mercy toward the offender, not the victim. Now, I'm not arguing that we should make the reverse mistake so that mercy is all oriented toward the victim and never to the offender, because let's face it, we are all offenders at some point or another in our life. This is why we have confessionals in the first place. This understanding that we're going to fall short and we need some sort of medicine to remedy it, the very medicine Christ himself provides in infinite supply from the cross. But never forget this about the cross. And, you know, this is how I would, I don't know if temper is the right word, because I understand Ray Larson, the prosecutor, I understand his mindset here. It is frustrating. It is frustrating to see victims given short shrift by the justice system. Victims, as he said, did not volunteer for this. They were chosen by the perp, and they have to live with what they've done to them, whether it's the absence of a loved one who was killed, or whether it's the haunting memory of the crime, they've got to live with this for years and years and years. But here's where what I would say to Larson is, in his frustration, you're placing your hope in perhaps in the wrong place. Because even if our justice system were perfect, even if those who commit crimes, you know, even if, as some people argue, for closure, to execute the offender. That's not going to bring back the person who was killed. This is the only thing that I would say, and to Larson or to all of us, is to be reminded of what the cross is. The cross is this incredible historical moment that lives on because it also transcends history, in which Christ himself identified with both the guilty offender, he himself who bore upon himself the sins of the world, and he also identified with every innocent victim who's ever suffered because of someone else. He himself, not only does he himself have the unique power in his own crucified and risen body to reconcile Jew and Gentile, to reconcile us with the Father, he alone has the power to reconcile offender and victim, because he himself knows what it's like, so to speak, to be both, to enter into the darkness, bearing upon himself the sins of the world, of being the offender, and knowing what it is to be the innocent. He is the quintessential innocent victim. More on this on the other side of the break. Would love to hear from you. 573-4-BREAD-4. This is The Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on Breadbox Media. Again, question of the day. If you're making a pot of chili, what are you going to put in it besides a spoon? 573-4-BREAD-4, 573-4-BREAD-4. A couple of emails I got from listener Bonnie. First thing she wrote, I guess, after the What Were You Thinking award, which went to a Florida resident. I said, Florida, you know, the one of the websites I go to, as a go-to source for these What Were You Thinking nominees is FARC.com. And they've got a whole, you know, they got categories and all kind of different little short news stories and links. And one of them, you know, they've got one titled Stupid, which are all kind of different stories. And one, well, I'll leave nameless, but they've got one whole category, Florida. So many of these things seem to happen in Florida. There's even an interesting Twitter account called Florida Man that you can follow on these sort of stories. Anyway, Bonnie says strange things always happen in Florida due to the heat affecting everyone's judgment. That's pretty good. She also talks about chili, Bonnie does, in a follow-up email. She says Fritos are good in chili. No doubt. I love that. Anything you can do with Fritos. What is it? Taco in a bag? You have a little bag of Fritos and put in the meat. But chili, same way. Same idea. I thought, Bonnie, great idea. I'm going to go get some Fritos next time we make it. And she also says, she said, I can't believe we're talking about chili. I made some Saturday to fake like we're having fall down here in Florida. Yeah, I guess you would have to fake it probably. She also extols golf and the Ryder Cup. How fun would it be if all golf was like that. Shannon makes the point about, you know, when she married with her husband, that his chili experience completely different than mine. And then she goes on to talk about that. You know, that I do marriage prep for the Diocese of Lexington here, my full-time work. That's probably an issue. You know, we talk about a lot of things. Communication, conflict resolution, family of origin, finances. We might need to throw chili in there too, because you know, you can make a lot of assumptions entering into marriage that your spouse likes chili the same way you do, and that could be big trouble. if you like chili a certain way. So great idea, Shannon. I think that needs to be added into our marriage preparation. 5734-BREAD-4, 5734-BREAD-4. Email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. I gave a test Friday to my Old Testament class. Test day is my favorite day because they get to squirm and I don't have to do anything except hand them a test and sit there and watch them take it. But they took a test on it was really on the whole book of Genesis, which is an amazing story. As I've told you before, my favorite book of the Bible is the book of Genesis. So rich. And my early perusal of their tests, I've got more grading yet to do. That's one of the things they never told me about teaching. You know, if you think teachers have this nice short work day and all the rest, you've never seen what grading is like, but I digress. Anyway, so I'll be grading their tests. But one of the fun things we had during the Genesis section, which lasted several weeks, because again, I think it's so foundational, we spend a disproportionate amount of time on it. But we got into a discussion one day. I had them rank in terms of moral virtue. And I can't remember whether I've talked about this on the program before, so I may have some early dementia going on. But had them rank this one chapter in Genesis, the chapter that tells the story of Jacob's deception of his father Isaac, who was blind and aged. You know, Jacob, who was born as a twin brother to Esau. Esau born first. He would have the right of the firstborn, but Jacob grasping his heel. That's allegedly what the name Jacob even means. It's heel grabber, usurper. And you see that reflected, of course, in Jacob's life, not only in tricking his brother or swindling his brother out of his birthright. He offers his brother some soup when he's really hungry. Jacob being the sort of homebody, Esau more of the rugged hunter type. He comes in famished. Jacob offers him the soup if he'll sell him his birthright. But it gets worse in the next chapter. Isaac, feeble and not good vision, he asks Esau, he says, go out and kill me some game, cook it up, come back that I may give you my paternal blessing, which is a powerful thing. They were words that, in the words of Pope Benedict Emeritus, were not just informative. That blessing was performative. It actually did something. And, of course, in the story, he goes off to hunt. Rebecca has heard this whole thing go on, Isaac's wife. She has a favorite. Favoritism of children, a problem in the book of Genesis, if you read it, the pattern. Remember Joseph in the coat of many colors. So Isaac's favorite is Esau. Rebecca's is Jacob. But she hears what's going on. She tells Jacob, go kill one of your goats. We'll cook something together. Then you go in and pretend to be your brother Esau. Put goat hair skins on your arms so that you'll seem more hairy like your brother. And it's quite an, again, as I said, these Genesis families put the fun in dysfunction. And I'm trying to help my students see that it's God, the actor in Genesis, who holds this whole thing together, not the virtue of the elect by any means. But I had them rank 1 through 4, who they thought was the most virtuous in the story and who was the least virtuous in the story of the four characters, Isaac, Rebecca, Jacob, and Esau. It's a bit of a problematic account because it's a little bit like the time I watched the episode of House of Cards. I decided I was going to try to watch another Netflix series like I had watched Breaking Bad. I've not been a binge watch series watcher on Netflix, but I thought I'd try House of Cards. I couldn't get past the first episode because there was not a redeeming character in the whole program. Everybody was corrupt. Everybody was conniving and everybody deceptive. It was ugly. I felt a little bit like that reading that chapter in Genesis, trying to find virtue there. And there are many stories like that. If you read about Jacob's children, my goodness, what a collection of the sons and the interplay between his two wives, who he was deceived into marrying, Leah and then Rachel, and then they're invoking their maidservants to help him have other children. It would make Jerry Springer proud. But I felt a little bit like that in terms of trying to find virtue in this story. And They end up ranking, but interestingly enough, they did not rank Jacob, who fooled his own father, robbed his own brother, Esau, of the blessing. They did not rank Jacob the worst. Only a second worst. The innocent victim, so to speak, in this was Isaac, of course. So he was the best. And then Esau, despite the fact that Esau wanted to murder Jacob after he'd done this. Then Jacob. But the worst they listed was Rebekah, because it was her idea to begin with. It was an interesting thought experiment. You know, we think about our family life and trying to find virtue in our own families. We tend to magnify our own virtue and criticize the vice in others, but maybe it bears more reflecting. Here's the good news, though. Where do you find virtue in Genesis? It's in the primary actor in Genesis. It's not the story of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The book of Genesis is the story of God and what God is doing through this remarkably dysfunctional family, but the golden thread of redemption continuing to run through it. Okay, let's get on to spin the dial catechism wheel. We got a couple minutes left. Let's dial up a number here between 1 and 2865, which is the total number of paragraphs in the catechism. Always the truth animating it, of course, that truth is never random, but always integrated within the panoramic totality of the faith. 2335 is the paragraph that we have dialed up. Having to go digital today. Just taking it a minute to dial up because I left my hard copy in the back of my car. So we'll listen to the music here for just a second as I wait for this little symbol to come up. Here we go. 2335. We're almost there. Don't lose heart. Here we go. We are, 2335. Uh-huh. Paragraph 2335. No, that's the index. Hold on. Let's see. I think here we go. 2335. Here we are. Finally, under the sixth commandment, you shall not commit adultery. This under the section, male and female, he created them. Each of the two sexes is an image of the power and tenderness of God, with equal dignity, though in a different way. The union of man and woman in marriage is a way of imitating in the flesh the Creator's generosity and fecundity. That's a great Catholic word I want us to bring back. It means fruitfulness or fertility. Therefore, a man leaves his father and his mother and cleaves to his wife, and they become one flesh. All human generations proceed from this union. Pretty remarkable, isn't it? This union of the two in one flesh. This is why this is central to the understanding of what marriage is. Two persons, equal in dignity, and yet distinct and different, and yet each needing the other, in a sense, to complete the image of God. This union of the two in one flesh imitates who God is, the love of the Blessed Trinity. Anyway, great section, 2335. Check it out in the Catechism. Be back with you tomorrow, by God's grace. Be talking to Dr. Wes Ely, among others, about bringing a Catholic approach to medicine. This is the Mike Allen Show. You've been listening to Breadbox Media.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.